You are back with The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. This is Catherine Cruz. And this morning, HPR reporter Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us with the latest on the spike in positive COVID cases on Lanai and in Hawaii County. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine, and good morning, everyone. I want to start with Hawaii County just because, you know, they've got a total case count so far of a little over 1,200 since the pandemic began. But on Sunday, this past Sunday, the Big Island did see a single day spike that got a lot of folks' attention.
Yes,
and
it did.
A single day total of 51 new coronavirus cases on Sunday that shot up the county's positivity rate to 3.8%, which is a lot higher than the rest of the state.
Yeah, when we heard that, it was yikes, because that was higher than Oahu.
Right, and which is surprising given the difference in population. But there was a concern early on by some in the community that perhaps this was the result of the reopening of travel. We know Trans-Pacific and Inter-Island travel to the Big Island had begun on October 22nd. But county officials did confirm that, you know, this spike was not the result of tourists, but rather a new testing strategy that the county has taken on. Mayor Harry Kim has mentioned that they're trying to get a better idea of clusters or hunt them out before they get started. And so a lot of the reports that come in from various either doctors or hospitals or private testing companies, private testing labs, once the reports on positive cases come into the Department of Health, that information is shared with the county, and then the county can sort of deploy testing around those cases, which, kind of surprised to say, it hasn't happened yet, but is this sort of spike in cases as a result of that is what Kim says. Here he is to kind of explain this three-tiered approach to testing, from district testing is what he's going to cover, and targeted testing. And then there's also spot testing. Here he is.
We have number one, what we call district test. That means every district on this island are tested as regular basis as possible to get a database of what's going on the whole island. And number two is what we call target testing, based on information of what we're getting. You know, let's say so many people went to the urgent care in Kona. You know, we get a copy of that report to the Department of Health, and you start to see, you know, numbers of 2, 3, 4 in a certain area. And that's what we identify as our target testing for a specific geographic area, and we have testing there that's free to the public.
Free to the public, right? So then they've got spot testing, which is not going to be open to the public, but that's in instances where they've seen, for example, residents in multifamily housing complexes, for example, or inmates at the Hawaii Community Correctional Center. When they see one or two positive cases, they'll send out the testing crews. The county has contracted three separate companies, Premier Medical Group, which we've heard of a lot across the state, but also S&G Labs and Ali'i Health, who has been doing a lot on the west side. And so the idea is to identify the potential for community clusters and try to prevent them before they happen.
So then the spike of the 51 cases that we saw over the weekend, was that a result of the spot testing?
So yes and no. There was spot testing at an affordable apartment complex in Pipe'ikil, where they were able to identify a cluster of about 15, and then another on the Kona side of about 23 at a housing area there. But this, you know, that doesn't account for all of the cases that were in that cluster. They are seeing a lot more on the west side of Hawaii Island recently, I guess. So, you know, everyone who's been following the uptick in cases on the Big Island noticed early on that there was a lot of activity on the Hilo side, social gatherings and sort of other types of events, and now like the Yukio Okutsu State Veterans Home. But now we're seeing some clusters pop up on the west side. I was able to speak to Kona Representative Nicole Lowen, who says she's had her and her staff have been monitoring, you know, the the case data and trying to figure out how they can get the word out to their community. But she's really wanting more in terms of enforcement, but also the narrative or the reason why these cases are popping up in Kona. She wants to know, is it a birthday party? Is it social gathering? Where can we put our resources to contain that spread? So here's Loin.
I wish Department of Health would provide a little more like narrative context around the case numbers. It's like we can track the data and kind of come up with it ourselves, but it is a lot of work. So it'd be nice if they would help do that, to put those case numbers into words that people understand. And then, you know, it would be great to see on Hawaii Island. I know that Oahu invested some CARES Act funds in like an enforcement unit within their PD. I think something like that, like a specific COVID enforcement unit, to really focus on, you know, getting people to wear masks and making sure businesses are doing their part, that could be really helpful as well.
So that is something that Mayor Kim had mentioned that he is open to, but we have not seen any movement yet on it. But over on Lanai, which has, I think, been on the minds of many here in Hawaii, the number of COVID-19 cases on the island seems to have stabilized, according to Mayor Victorino. A second round of testing is planned for Saturday, and the county health officials are urging residents to get tested a second time to see what that snapshot of COVID looks like in that small community. So far, 94 confirmed cases of COVID-19 on the island, which may seem like a small amount, but when you think about the overall population of Lanai, a little under 3,000 people, you've got one school, one gas station, two grocery stores. When you talk about community transmission and the potential in such a small, tight-knit community, that was really the early-on concern for a lot of healthcare officials. But we got to speak to Lanai resident and former Maui County Councilman and State Representative for the island, Saul Kaho'ohalahala, who had mentioned that, you know, he was a bit surprised of the news because his sort of immediate circle had been just really taking all these precautions to keep Lanai COVID-free. And so when he realized that, you know, COVID is on island, I think a lot of the island was sort of shook by that. What do we do now? We know healthcare officials were saying early on that the majority of the cases were multifamily housing units, and you know, the potential for within the family transmission was a worry. But Kaho'ohalahala sort of took a bigger picture step back to see what Lanai hopes to learn from this little outbreak.
Perhaps this was the moment in time that we needed to reassess our situation. And for Hawaii, is it okay for us to go back to what we would refer to as normal, and perhaps reassess whether or not that was truly a normal part of Hawaii? And if not, then it requires us to begin to make the policy changes and begin to be serious about that, so that we can fully accommodate what is necessary for us to be self-reliant and sustained in Hawaii, meaning a healthy economy, healthy people, healthy environment.
So Lanai right now is under lockdown, and I think these ideas and thinking about the future for their island is really, you know, part of what's going on in the community.
Yeah, and I was watching the news conference with the mayor, and I know he had said, fortunately, a lot of the folks aren't really serious. I think they've medevaced, I think, one to Oahu, one to Maui, and then the others were just being treated on island. But we've got to keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully everybody, you know, maintains and is not too serious.
Yes, yeah. Thoughts and prayers for those on Lanai.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Mahalo.
That was Kuvehi Horiishi. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from YWCA of Kauai, with a confidential hotline for domestic violence or sexual assault at 245-6362. Also, online chat and texting support accessible at ywcakauai.org.
Aloha, this is Jose Fajardo, president of Hawaii Public Radio. We successfully concluded our fall membership campaign on Wednesday with over $636,000 in contributions, and we also welcomed 721 new members. HPR has been here for you, and during this membership campaign, you were there for us. A sincere mahalo for making HPR possible, now and into the future.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Community Foundation, addressing COVID-19 by deploying resources to help avoid its spread, protecting those in Hawaii who are considered vulnerable. HawaiiCommunityFoundation.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Time now to test you with our backyard quiz.
Unihua.
In today's backyard quiz, a little-known story from Hawaii's history. This one is about an intrepid group of voyagers who set out in the early 19th century and made their mark on an island chain far from home. These Western Pacific Islands were settled in 1830 by Hawaiians who brought their culture with them to a little-known location 1,000 kilometers due south of Tokyo. The group of some 30 islands remains settled to this day. It's a prefecture of Japan and home to descendants of those original Hawaiian settlers. The island's isolation has allowed unique species to evolve there and has given them the nickname of the Galapagos of the Pacific. We are looking for the name of this unique and very out-of-the-way settlement. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Locations, whose realtors and staff support HPR's commitment to sharing stories of Hawaii. Updated property listings, including virtual tours and a mobile app, at locationshawaii.com.
About a week since the state announced a new $25 million grant program to help small businesses deal with their economic crisis. More than 1,000 companies have applied so far. Many businesses were on the cusp of closing their doors due to reduced sales and new COVID-related expenses. Governor David Ige announced the launch of the new Hawaii Business Pivot Program in partnership with the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii. Sharon Minor McNamara is the chamber president. She spoke with the Conversation's producer, Harrison Patino, about the response so far.
Since we launched a Hawaii Business Pivot Grant Program last week, we already received up to 1,138 grant applications. So you can imagine the need for this resource. And while the deadline to apply is November 23rd, it is really until we run out of money. So we encourage businesses to apply as soon as possible.
Now, I think when most people think of small businesses, the first thing that comes to mind is just restaurants. But do you have a sense of who and what sort of businesses are seeking out these loans?
Oh, it varies from the restaurants to retail to service industries to those who offer consulting services. It really does vary. Again, it shows the impact COVID-19 on a broad range, impacting different industries of all sizes.
Now, what's the scope of what these grants are designed to cover cost-wise?
The grant provides reimbursements up to $10,000, and it is for reimbursements that are not related to payroll or rent, because we believe that other grants have covered that. So this grant is more about supporting a business who has to pivot during COVID. So whether it's to cover e-commerce or equipment or other types of services that businesses had to change their way of doing business in order to reflect the current environment and the path forward.
Now, could you break that down a little bit? Because specifically, these are pivot loans. So what is this idea of having to pivot as a business over these last several months?
Let's say, for example, web development, design, social media, and e-commerce. As you know, when we had the shelter-in-place orders, many had to operate from home, and many had to stay at home. So in order to continue their commerce, they had to pivot to online. Also, consulting services. Consulting with companies that can provide them support as well as advice on how to recreate or redesign or reimagine their business, as well as equipment and supplies. And it also covers physical distancing measures, but only expenses incurred after October 1st. And that's because, again, we believe some other grants that are available have already covered that, such as PPP loans and county grants.
Now, speaking more generally, and I know it's harder to speak broadly about the entire scope of small business in Hawaii, but what's your sense of how small business in the state is currently faring?
You know, we've done numerous surveys already, and a couple of them partnered with UHERO, and the numbers are very telling. 75% of businesses across the state were forced to make some type of reductions. About 40% said they couldn't reopen until tourism restarted, which was recently. And about 40% of businesses, they cannot survive COVID much longer unless there's additional resources. So you can imagine, while this pivot grant helps them, this is not the only resource that we need to continue to push for. We need to continue to push for more support as we move forward in, on the path to economic recovery.
Now, there's a pretty significant voice within the small business owners of the state saying that the current state and local administrations aren't doing enough to safeguard small businesses. Do you think the rollout of this loan program and other loan programs like it are evidence to the contrary of that?
Yeah, you know, initially, I believe, no one had a playbook for COVID, whether private sector or public sector. So it happened in such a short time frame, pretty much overnight. Everyone was faced with insurmountable and monumental impact that how to address it. So, you know, it was a slow start. However, that's why it's even more critical to have collaborative efforts, public-private partnerships, and this Hawaii Business Pivot Grant is a resource that resulted in a public-private partnership, along with the Hawaii Restaurant Card Program. So as we move forward as a state and to continue with this economic recovery, as well as revitalizing our economy, it will take this kind of effort.
Now, the focus on these loans specifically is pivoting models and practices to adjust to COVID-19 regulations, but there's been a lot of talk about how businesses are hurting specifically due to reduced operating capacity. Now, in your opinion, is it realistic to think that a significant number of at-risk small businesses can survive on simply pivoting their business models alone?
You know, it's not the only solution, and that's why it's going to be critical that we continue to find ways to help our small businesses survive during this most challenging, indescribable time for our local business community. And that means coming up with different and creative programs, supporting local, and continuing to find different financial resources. And we know the CARES money is going to run out soon, so we urge Congress to pass some kind of financial support for businesses so that they can continue to keep the doors open, continue to provide jobs. Because if not, we cannot afford to go backwards, and let alone another shutdown. And so that's how we have to do everything in our power to find different resources in different ways. This is an opportunity as we move forward as a state to address the issues that were ongoing pre-COVID, and that has been the cost of doing business here in Hawaii. It's always been high and one of the highest in the nation. And so what can we do to systematically change and address the current environment? And that can be done through policies. And we hope that we can start these discussions in finding ways to address cost of doing business, as well as cost of living and opportunities that can help with expanding our economic base. Tourism will always be here, and on the immediate term, we need to continue to invest in it, support in it, and find ways to to continue to bring back visitors in a safe way. At the same time, we need to step up our efforts in having constructive discussions as to what industries here in Hawaii that we need to amp up our investments and resources so that we can expand the economic base, have higher paying jobs, and start getting our unemployed back to jobs.
Now, as we're in the second week of that soft tourism reopening, are you getting a tangible sense from local businesses that they're seeing a boost in commerce because of that reopening?
Yes, we've heard some businesses already that there's been an uptick. The Hawaii Restaurant Card Program launched around the same time. So with the Hawaii Restaurant Card Program and visitors returning, we definitely have heard from businesses that they're seeing an increase in commerce and activities. So, you know, that's encouraging. But we have to make sure at the same time that we all have and take our personal responsibility in doing our part so that we can continue to keep the case count down because, again, our local business community cannot afford another shutdown, and we need to do our part in ensuring that we can save our businesses, save our jobs, and save our local families by doing our part.
That was Sherry Minor McNamara, President and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii. She was talking with the Conversations producer, Harrison Patino, about a $25 million rollout of grants to help small businesses adjust to COVID-19 marketplace changes. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nick Ruby joins us today with a story about an ongoing battle to get information about Honolulu police officers accused of wrongdoing. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
So this story of Officer Darren Cachola has been in the headlines for several years now.
Yeah, that's right. Darren Cachola is a pretty well-known name in Hawaii at this point, and not for any good reasons. In 2014, Cachola, who's a sergeant in the Honolulu Police Department, was caught on a surveillance video that was leaked to the press, essentially pummeling his girlfriend in a Waipahu restaurant. Now, once that video became public, there was widespread outrage. There were lots of news stories about it. The Hawaii legislature, at least the women of the Hawaii legislature, demanded action from the Honolulu Police Department. Bills were introduced to address domestic violence within the ranks of the HPD. And Sergeant Cachola ultimately was never charged. Now, HPD, of course, tried to fire him, but the police union was successful in getting Sergeant Cachola his job back. Now, it took until 2018 for us to find out about that. But the problem is we as the public don't really know why exactly he was getting his job back. Over the years, we've learned that Sergeant Cachola had gotten into other trouble with the police department and had been accused of other acts of alleged domestic violence as well. But the arbitrator's decision that gave him his job back is secret, and the police union is fighting in court right now to make sure it remains confidential.
Now, as far as then the release of the information, I guess, you know, why is SHOPO just not being, you know, upfront about the arbitration?
Well, this all goes back for many years in which SHOPO was successful in carving out an exemption in Hawaii's public records law that protected police officers' disciplinary files. For the most part, if a police officer was suspended for misconduct, that record was shielded from public view. Now, no other public employee was afforded this exemption in the public records law. For instance, if you're a college professor and you get suspended for sexual harassment, the public has a right to find out that information. But if you're a police officer who gets suspended for, say, assaulting a family member, the public doesn't really learn about what happened there. Now, SHOPO has been fighting for years to ensure that exemption stays in place. But this year, the Hawaii legislature changed that and changed the law, and they basically got rid of that exemption, saying, you know, it's time for more transparency. Of course, we've seen a lot of calls for more police oversight and accountability, both locally and nationally, in the past couple of years. And so once that law disappeared, you would think that Sergeant Cotrola's suspension records, which includes this arbitration decision, would become public. Yet the police union is still arguing that it should remain private for any number of reasons, including that they think that Sergeant Cotrola still has a privacy interest in keeping his arbitration decision secret. They also don't think that the law that the legislature passed should apply retroactively, even though lawmakers, when they passed the law, said specifically that the law should apply retroactively to officers' suspension record.
Well, I was intrigued because your article mentions that they don't even want to tell you who the arbitrator is, you know, and yeah, I'm just scratching my head. It's just kind of like, you know, with all the calls for transparency, that they're still giving you folks some grief, you know, to just produce the material. So you folks have then, what, filed a motion in court?
That's right. So Civil Beat has fought to get access to police records for many years, and our lawyer, Brian Black, recently filed a motion in court asking the Supreme Court to make the to basically make Schoppo's lawsuit trying to keep this arbitration decision confidential moot in light of the new law. So we're just waiting on the Supreme Court to decide on that, and hopefully we will get a decision soon and possibly even see Sergeant Cotrola's arbitration decision. I will note that I have received other arbitration decisions from HPD in the past. It's just this is one that Schoppo is fighting to keep secret.
Yeah, really interesting. Thanks so much. And so we will wait for the outcome of this. But thanks so much, Nick.
Great. Thanks a lot, Catherine. Appreciate it.
That was reporter Nick Ruby with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, head to civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Kamran Samimi, In Stillness, with works exploring ideas of space, time, and impermanence. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Book clubs with engaging discussions, trivia nights with lively but friendly competition, cocktail tutorials taught by Hawaii's leading bartenders. What do all of these have in common? They're examples of events put on by Generation Listen, a group of younger listeners who love HPR and connecting with other public radio nerds. These virtual events are free or inexpensive, are always a good time, and you're invited, no matter what island you're on. Follow us on social at HPR Gen Listen.
Throughout the week, we've been focusing on the state of our environment. Heiloni Moku is a report that gives us an update of our islands. It's a project of the Environmental Funders Group, a mix of philanthropic organizations ranging from the Hawaii Community Foundation to Kamehameha Schools. Today, we talk about the future of sustainable transportation with Ulupono Initiative's Katie Rooney.
I think it's important to sort of frame out that there's sort of two ends of the spectrum in way people are seeing autonomous vehicles deploy out. And this is summarized by the Transportation Research Board, which is one of our national academies of science at the federal level. And they sort of outline two different ways of thinking about it. One way is through a certain set of policy interventions, you could reduce energy consumption with autonomous vehicles and emissions and see a lot of the other safety benefits and access benefits, you know, over the next 30 years. But on the flip side, without some sort of policy interventions, we're looking at some combination of lots of zero occupancy vehicles and continual reliance on fossil fuels that, you know, puts the energy consumption and emissions up to 200% over this same time period. So there's a lot of choices to be made. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion around autonomous vehicles. We generally like to sort of support a specific type of autonomous vehicle framework or approach, which is called ACEs, which is when they're automated, when they're accessible, when they're connected, when they're electric, and then when they're shared. And that's really how you kind of capture the benefits of the first potential scenario or end of the spectrum, as opposed to sort of being shoved into the less than ideal one, in which there's just a lot more cars on the road driving with or without people in them.
Well, how do you put in the infrastructure, you know, when we've got, you know, a kind of a free market?
I mean, transportation infrastructure is not necessarily a free market. I mean, there's certainly a huge portion that is consumer driven around your choice of vehicles, but most roadways are publicly owned. Transportation and traffic management is usually publicly oriented. So, I mean, it's definitely more of a mixed system. And even right now, Hawaii DOT just in the last month announced a big pilot on Nimitz and Ala Moana, installing new connected vehicle infrastructure on 30 intersections. So we're starting to see that investment happen. I mean, we're not necessarily as far along as other communities. This past month, Waymo announced it's going to have driverless taxi service in Arizona. So, you know, there's a lot happening in this area. And even if you're not like at 100% level five, there's five levels of autonomy, is kind of how folks talk about it in the transportation field, we're still in the process of building those blocks to support it.
Where are the models across the globe? Who's ahead in this game?
Worldwide, there's a lot of different options. South Korea usually gets touted. In the U.S., which, you know, obviously has a slightly different model, you see places like Pittsburgh, Columbus, Arizona, but they all have different sort of frameworks. There really hasn't one come out as like the clear winner, the one that sort of balances safety against private investment, against catalyzing new technologies. There's a lot still happening. There's a lot of diversity in how people choose to regard and approach autonomous vehicles. And then also whether or not they want to take that next step, which is really trying to ensure that the benefits of autonomous vehicles, you know, for all community members are insured. And that takes another step of activity and policy. Last I heard, there's over 120 pilots of autonomous vehicles happening in the United States right now. There's a lot out there. So I think that that's an important note. Sometimes people think of this as the technology of the future, but it's really on the ground today, just in a lot of different ways. In Columbus, Ohio, with the Smart Columbus Initiative, where they spent their time and resources putting in a shuttle into that's called the Linden Leap, which is a shared, accessible autonomous vehicle circulator that was going to go and help serve an underserved community. And then COVID hit, and they actually repurposed it into a food delivery system, which I think is sort of showing, you know, on the ground how some of these benefits can be captured. It just doesn't have to be just a replacement for the travel we already engage in vehicles.
What else should we be looking for when it comes to sustainability and transportation?
I think we just have to make sure that we're paying attention. There are a lot of safety benefits, you know, that come with this when we take sort of humans out of the driver's seat. But, you know, improving access for people who can't drive, improving access to areas that have been historically underserved, if we aren't paying attention to those sorts of things, as well as the emissions from fossil fuel-based systems, I think we don't know. And I think that's one of the big challenges, is making sure that we're not just focusing on whether something's feasible or can it be applied, but are we setting up the right kinds of policy frameworks and evaluation scenarios where we're able to then say, like, no, it does do this. It does improve access. It does help us meet our climate goals. It does provide new transportation services, not just a service that, again, replaces the car you may already have.
We saw what happened with COVID-19 and companies like Lyft and Uber, where folks were reluctant to share. They don't want to share germs. You know, I'd rather drive in my own car, and they don't want to take public transportation. So, you know, how are you looking at that?
There's a few different ways of looking at it, actually. One is that, generally speaking, we have not seen transit being a space where COVID outbreaks have been happening. So the fear around shared in general may not be a fair one. And in fact, some of that might have to be around people aren't in those vehicles long enough for high levels of exposure. Mask wearing is very high. So there's a lot of research that's coming out that sort of suggests that fear is a little bit unfounded. A second thing is that there's sort of the shared vehicle space, is there's a lot of need still for it, for essential workers in a variety of scenarios where people can't necessarily opt out of either transit, which are obviously like large shared vehicles, or the smaller ones. I think it's something we have to look at. We're seeing some pretty fundamental shifts in transportation sort of the evaporation of the peak congestion periods, you know, the elimination of longer commutes, a lot more shorter trips happening, and sort of an explosion of bike and potentially pedestrian trips. So we're seeing a lot of changes that, you know, we aren't necessarily entirely sure how they're all going to play out. And I think it's sort of a little bit of a wait and see, and maybe making sure that we're monitoring them so that if opportunities present themselves, we can take advantage of them.
And there was a report released recently about the cost of parking here in Hawaii. You know, with COVID, A lot of folks are working at home, working remotely, you know, so how does that factor in?
I mean, it factors in a few different ways. One of the ways is that in some cases, people obviously aren't driving as much and may not have as much need for a vehicle if their work trip is no longer there. So that parking space may not be all that valuable to them anymore. So that's one aspect of it. Another one is, in that report you mentioned, we actually lined up one of the profiles of people to match up with UHERO's profiles for people who might need rental support. And when you kind of look at it, UHERO was talking about how the state was probably, for that particular profile, going to have to provide $600 of a monthly rental support for someone to stay in their home. And when you dig into it against our report, you sort of realize that 50% of that is actually potentially going towards the required parking. So we're actually making sure their cars have housing, but we are not actually necessarily making sure they have housing. Or the other way of thinking about it is that if people weren't required to have parking with their apartments or their houses, as opposed to having the choice, right, that could have helped maybe twice as many people for the same amount of money. Parking takes up a good amount of space. Removing the requirements does not mean that nobody ever builds parking. What it means is that we assess whether or not parking is needed in that location, and people have a choice. Right now, we're allowed to build more than the minimum. If a developer or anybody wants to have three spaces, they can sort of get three spaces. Even if there's just a one-bedroom unit, we just don't allow for the reverse. And that's what our report was really trying to get at, was sort of show is that we're requiring people to pay for something they may or may not be using. One of the statistics put out by the city and county of Honolulu is that 43% of our households are one car or less. But if you're in a three-bedroom unit, you may be paying for three spaces. And it's not true everywhere. There are certainly places in which, you know, parking is at a premium and it's certainly constrained. But those would be the places where perhaps then you would provide more. But in other places, that's not necessarily true. And then, you know, the more parking we build, the further and further apart each individual building is. It makes it harder to get folks closer to transit, to other options. It lengthens their trips. So there's a whole host of benefits you get from allowing people to choose how much parking they want, as opposed to mandating that everybody has to pay for a base amount, no matter their circumstance. Sort of mentioned earlier, we're seeing some pretty big shifts in terms of congestion and how people are traveling. That certainly makes an argument that all of our road space being sort of dominated by vehicles is maybe not the most appropriate way of approaching it, that perhaps we need to do some of those things. And I know the city and county has been doing that with some of their bike lanes work and the new bus only lane. But I think, you know, having more of that, because the great thing about those types of approaches is we can change them back. Are things safer? Are people able to walk and bike more effectively? Does traffic move, you know, maybe more slowly, but at a better rate that's safer for the context? You know, you throw in some parking management. Can people actually find parking now, which does not always happen because people have a tendency to use on-street parking for long-term vehicle storage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot that we can play with. And under the circumstances, given that national trends sort of suggest that there's been this really big increase in shorter trips in like the 1 to 3 miles, it seems like we should think about how do we start to both accommodate, but then also foster more of that, because all of that just helps the lifetime of our transportation investments. And, you know, and just active transportation is one of the few ways you could exercise when we've locked down, has been basically walking and biking. And I have heard stories, although I didn't see it too much, of places where the sidewalks are packed and the roads are empty. We do have this opportunity to sort of say, this is how we have done it. There's some pretty big changes. We need to be thinking about what does that mean and how does it look differently? And I think also supporting a lot more bike and pedestrian trips. We have this sort of opportunity where people are open to them and things have changed. And I think that that's really important, and how to continue that fostering so that it's not just pushing out the projects we had in the queue, but rather what are the new projects and what are the new trends that we should be responding to right now.
That was part of a conversation we had with Katie Rooney of Ulupono, talking about keeping ahead of transportation trends to spot opportunities as we try and become a more resilient community. For links to the Hei Lonomoku report, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about an island chain in the Western Pacific that was settled in the early 19th century by ocean-going pioneers from Hawaii. They arrived on the islands in 1830, and they brought their customs, language, and technology with them. The main settlement they established, Port Lloyd, became a popular stopping-off place for whaling ships that ranged far and wide throughout the Pacific in the early decades of the 19th century. Even today, the islands are an abundant source of rare wildlife, so much so that they were named a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2011. Fewer than 3,000 people live there today, many of them tracing their ancestry to those early settlers. They're citizens of Japan, and their home is known as the Ogasawara Islands, also known in the West as the Bonin Islands. And congratulations to our winner, Dean from Palolo. You got it right. That's today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
What if the real political divide in our country isn't about right and left? What if it's between those who care intensely about politics and those who don't?
People don't seem to dislike somebody just for being a member of the other side. They're concerned that somebody is going to talk to them about politics.
Reimagining the political divide in the U.S. this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7, following Says You.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Puahana, now open on Waialae Avenue in Kaimuki, featuring fresh flowers and lei, floral arrangements, and more. On the web at puahanahawaii.com.
Earlier this week, law enforcement announced the rescue of 5 minors from the threats of sex trafficking. Details about the cases haven't been released, but it throws a light on the ongoing need to protect our youth from being preyed on. Homeless teens often find themselves vulnerable to criminals, and during this pandemic, our social service needs have mushroomed. That includes a demand for programs to help our homeless youth. We caught up with Carla Hauser with a nonprofit, RISE. It stands for Residential Youth Services Empowered. When we first chatted with Hauser about a year or so ago, she was proud to announce the opening of new bed space for teens in Kailua. Since then, RISE has expanded in Haleiwa and in Manoa just this month.
We did all this amazing work with street outreach and being able to bring young people in off the streets. But one of our biggest challenges was, what do we do with them afterwards? You know, with the high cost of housing, lack of really affordable housing, especially for young people who tend to be undereducated, underemployed. We needed to be part of the solution in finding affordable housing for our young people. So it's just what we did.
Have you seen any numbers rise at all this year?
We have. You know, we're seeing more and more young people. Part of that is due to the, you know, increased great work that we're doing around the commercially sexually exploited children. There's been a lot of change in the legislation that kind of decriminalizes childhood, you know, prostitution. And now we're treating these youth as the actual victims that they are of trafficking or exploitation. And so we've seen more of an effort by law enforcement and also service providers to provide support to young people. We've also seen an uptick. Even though we have a rent moratorium, there are still a lot of, you know, unsavory folks out there that, you know, at the first chance of not getting any sort of rent from our young people will go ahead and evict. And so we, our outreach teams and some of our business partners in the community are reporting, you know, greater upticks of young people living in cars and, you know, other places not meant for human, you know, habitation. And so, you know, it seems often for every one young person that we are actually able to transition out of the shelter, two more than show up. So, you know, the work is never done. So we're always looking for other opportunities and how to help young people transition out of homelessness and get on the right track.
Talk about the new facility over on the North Shore.
The Holly Eva Project, as it is affectionately known in the community, is a partnership with Alaya Bridge and ASI. The three organizations came together, and we felt that, you know, we could use our powers for good in a way that used community collaboration and kind of our networking abilities. Because we already have a partnership with Alaya Bridge in the Wahiwa Central Oahu North Shore, they do a lot of the street outreach for us looking for young people. It seemed like a natural transition to have them be part of this project. It's the former COISA building, Central Oahu Youth Services. After 30 years, they have decided to kind of close their organization, but the property belongs to city and county, and they wanted it to continue to serve, you know, youth populations. And so our youth housing collaborative of ASI, RISE, and Alaya Bridge went in. We've done a lot of renovations, and we're now really honored to be able to provide affordable housing for 15 young people. The property itself is a few acres, and there are 3 5-bedroom houses on that property. And so the idea is that once we get youth established and, you know, get them the right amount of sleep, the right amount of supportive services, and when they're ready to live more independently, we transition them, those young people that want to live in Holly Eva, they have an opportunity to go there and, you know, at an affordable rate. They pay $650 a month, and that includes utilities. They have full-time staff support on site. It's just a little extra, you know, support to help them get on their feet. You know, transitioning, you know, from adolescence to living on your own is sometimes a very daunting task for young people. By us being able to provide wraparound, you know, supportive services, that idea of being able to learn how to live independently with good wraparound supports is really what we're trying to create.
And where are you at with the Leeward Project?
Leeward Project is part of the Youth Homeless Demonstration Project. Again, that is looking to be a partnership with ASI and creating more transitional housing and then rapid rehousing for young people. So that project is still in the works. We also opened the Canoe House, which is here in Kailua, and that is a shelter for unaccompanied minors that are at risk of COVID. So that has been a project that have long wanted to be able to start. We know that there's a growing number of unaccompanied minors that will lay low under the radar, stay away from law enforcement, stay away from, you know, CWS. And it's really our idea, our vision, that, you know, we can give these young people a safe place to sleep, a safe place to kind of start to rebuild relationships with adults, and, you know, get them on a pathway that includes education and employment services.
So when we first talked, I guess, a couple of years ago, I think you had just opened the Kailua Center, mm-hmm. and you just had about a dozen beds, I thought.
Yeah. You know, on June 4th, 2018, we opened the 20-bed shelter in Kailua. It's on the Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility campus. And about 2 weeks of opening, we were completely full with a very extensive wait list. So, you know, despite our center being located, you know, in the middle of a 400-acre ag land, we're about a mile from the nearest bus stop, yet we demonstrated that there was absolutely a need on this island. We saw over 150 young people in 2019 who were able to come to us and really try and, you know, work on their life and ending, which for so many of them is, you know, generational homelessness. And to be able to come, get connected to employment, education services, to start to heal some of the trauma that they've experienced, You know, for many of our young people, almost 50% came in with some sort of diagnosis, whether it's mental health, substance use disorders. And so we really are ground zero for a lot of these young people in you know, figuring out adulting 101 and what that looks like.
And the Canoe House, is the focus a little different, or is it the same as it was when you originally started?
It is. You know, initially we opened the Canoe House under the premise that for any unaccompanied minors that were at risk of COVID. And so we've worked collectively with the state to be able to provide a bed space for respite, whether it's, you know, minors that are coming from a program on mainland to be able to come here and safely do their 14-day quarantine before they get moved into another program, whether it's therapeutic foster home or maybe some drug treatment program. We've been able to serve that need for the community. And looking to expand that if and when we get out from underneath of COVID, again, having another shelter option that doesn't require connecting youth, you know, to child welfare or trying to reunite them with family that maybe isn't, you know, in their best interest, but really providing a very low barrier, safe place for youth to come to kind of run to so that they can start to heal and get those wraparound supports. We've also opened up in Manoa, in the Makiki area. We're just opening up a 7-bedroom program for victims of crime. So any of our young people that have experienced child abuse, sex trafficking, it was really important for us to continue to create these programs that just catch young people. For so often, you know, I've been doing this almost 10 years, and, you know, there always seems to be a gap where kids fall through, whether it's, you know, foster youth who are not quite ready to, you know, take advantage of the Emu'akako and some of the housing subsidies. We still needed someplace to catch them.
We've been hearing from Carla Hauser, Executive Director of the RISE Project, which has been that safety net for homeless teens here on Oahu. We were talking about the progress being made to get our young people in need off the streets and into safe places. Well, that's a wrap for today. Up tomorrow, Noe Tanigawa takes you into the weekend for an Aloha Friday show with a rundown on stories about culture and the arts. We'd love some feedback. Got questions about mask wearing or distance learning or anything you might have heard on our air. Call our talkback line. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Connect with Facebook and Twitter. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.